G'day, and welcome to another episode of Left After Breakfast, coming to you from Melbourne, Australia, broadcast from the studios of 3CR, your only radio left. My name is Susanna Duffy.
3CR.
In our history, we have seen just two armed uprisings between white settlers and government forces. That was the Eureka Revolt of 1854 and the Queensland Shearers' Strike of 1891. The price of wool was falling in 1891, or so they say. In the late 1880s in London, Barings Bank had been backing some very dodgy loans on land in Argentina. Lands didn't actually belong to the people who were selling them, and there was some drama there, as you can imagine. So there was some difficulty with that London bank, which of course spread to other banks, which of course spread right across the economic spectrum. In 1891, there was an economic depression triggered by the insolvency of the Barings Bank, but the price of wool had not dropped very much. It was a bit lower, but nothing too dramatic, and any grower, any exporter could have covered that without any trouble at all. But it was used as an excuse to make more and more profits. And the best way to make profits in a tight market is to cut down on the wages you're paying to your employees. I think we've heard that story before. Gina Reinhart believes that $2 a day is perfectly okay for Australian workers in the 21st century. So, back in 1891, the men who owned the acres said, "All right, there's a few farthings short of our profits this year, boys. We won't take it. We'll cut back their wages. Oh, don't care about the shearers' union. We'll fix them." So the shearers said that they weren't going to take it. No way. You know that story too. You know how it goes. An early example of all bosses are bastards. By 1850, Australia was producing more than £1 million weight of wool each year. And by 1900, there were more than 100 million sheep in the country. When you think that a good shearer could shear more than 200 sheep a day, you can see that this is big, big business. In the outback, the springtime meant shearing. And that's when the pastoralists needed shearers to clip their flocks.
Springtime it brings on the shearing, and it's then you will see them in droves to the west country job off the coast, with a ragged old swag on his shoulder, and a billy quart pot in my hand. Oh, I tell you, we'll astonish the new chums to see how we travel the land. From the billabong Lorden, to the far Tatiara and back, all the mountains and plains are well trodden by the men on the wallaby track, with a ragged old swag on my shoulder, and a billy quart pot in my hand. Oh, I tell you, we'll astonish the new chums to see how we travel the land. There are many who stick during shearing and then shoulder their swag on their back. For the rest of the year they'll be steering on their well-beloved wallaby track, with a ragged old swag on his shoulder and a billy quart pot in my hand. Oh, I tell you, we'll astonish the new chums to see how we travel the land. And after the shearing is over, and the wool season's all at an end, it's then you will see those flash shearers making Johnny cakes round on the bend, with a ragged old swag on my shoulder and a billy quart pot in my hand. Oh, I tell you, we'll astonish the new chums to see how we travel the land.
Springtime, it brings on the shearing.
Now there's a song I haven't heard for years, and sung by an old mate of mine, Martin Wyndham Reid. By 1890, the Amalgamated Shearers' Union of Australasia had tens of thousands of members. Thousands of sheds were unionised. In 1890, a rule was put down: no working with non-union shearers. And shortly after, at John Darren Station on the Darling Downs, union members walked off the sheds demanding that the non-union labour be removed. But the non-union Labour was still able to process the war, and the John Darren shearers call for help. The Rockhampton wharfies responded. They refused to touch the John Darren wall. The union won the battle. The squatters were galvanised to create the Pastoralist General Council to counter the strength of the union. In 1891, during that depression caused by bank failure after dodgy land sales in Argentina, the price of wool did fall, although not by much. But it was the squatters' excuse to rid themselves of unionised workers. The shearers refused to accept the huge reductions in wages, and with their livelihoods in dire threat, they once again went out on strike. The squatters called for non-union men to come up and shear. They called for scab labour. But what exactly is a scab?
After God had finished the rattlesnake, the toad, and the vampire, he had some awful substance left with which he made a scab. A scab is a two-legged animal with a corkscrew soul, a waterlogged brain, and a combination backbone made of jelly and glue. Where others have hearts, he carries a tumor of rotten principles. When a scab comes down the street, men turn their backs and angels weep in heaven, and the devil shuts the gates of hell to keep him out. No man has a right to scab as long as there is a pool of water deep enough to drown his body in, or a rope long enough to hang his carcass with. Judas Iscariot was a gentleman compared with a scab. For betraying his master, he had character enough to hang himself. A scab hasn't.
The strikers set up camps at stations near Barcaldine and Claremont in Queensland. There was an awful atmosphere of threatening civil war, with armed troops dispatched to protect the scabs. Unionists retaliated by harassing the scabs and by acts of sabotage against the squatters. Fences were destroyed. Wool sheds were torched. Vitriol flowed on both sides. The riot act was read to the shearers. They were warned that any shot they fired, any blow they struck, was a direct attack on the rights of capital, and therefore a direct attack on Her Majesty the Queen, and that this was treason and was punishable by death. The punishment for death by treason was to be hanged, drawn, and quartered, and it was still on the books. The strike began to lose momentum in March when police arrested strike leaders in Barcaldine and Claremont. On May the 20th, 1891, in a packed Rockhampton courthouse, 13 of the men were sentenced to 3 years hard labour on St. Helena Island in Moreton Bay. Henry Lawson was moved to write his Freedom on the Wallaby.
So we must fly a rebel flag, as others did before us. And we must sing a rebel song and join in rebel chorus. We'll make the tyrants feel the sting of those that they would throttle. They needn't say the fault is ours if blood should stain the wattle.
3CR.
Now let's have a look at the song itself, the Ballad of 1891. I love this song, stirring song. It's something that sounds like it came from the pen of Henry Lawson, doesn't it? It's got that sort of the Lawson ring somehow. But no, two women wrote that song. Helen Palmer wrote the words and Doreen Bridges composed the music. The ballad itself gained popularity in 1953 when it appeared in a musical called Reedy River, about the 1891 shearers' strike. And this was a musical put on by New Theatre. And of course, the song gained a lot of popularity after that. But somehow the authorship was forgotten or overlooked or just ignored. Both Helen Palmer and Doreen Bridges worked in education. Palmer was an active member of the New South Wales Teachers Federation, and she made significant contributions to the campaigns for equal pay and for improved working conditions. I have here a recording from 1985 of Doreen Bridges talking about the ballad of 1891. And she talks about how it was just used by a group called the Bushwhackers with no accreditation given whatsoever. And when it was pointed out to them that they didn't do anything about it. So these are Doreen's own words. Now, as I said, it's an old recording and it hasn't been edited. And I don't want to edit it in any way, listener. I want to give it to you just the way it was all those years ago.
I think 1891 took on because it found its way to Melbourne and Dick Diamond seized on it and put it into Reedy River. It was not written for Reedy River.
I was presumed it was.
Everybody
actually
thinks it was. But it became the centrepiece of Reedy River because it was so relevant to the story,
absolutely.
You see.
I think they might have written the play to fit the song,
and
I think.
I think it's only become popular because there was a record made of the songs then.
Yes.
By Diaphon, and later on another recording was made when we did it here.
My husband sang in the first Reedy River in Melbourne.
And I think that's really why it became so well known, because it was Reedy River's been performed all over the place, all over the
amazing,
place. Absolutely amazing.
New Theatre's first great success.
Yes, but all sorts of little country towns put it on. Now, Helen was, she was extremely particular about songs and poems and things that she wrote, and she had a big row with New Theatre because they, when they first put on Reedy River here, they didn't acknowledge it, and she had great correspondence with Miriam and
yeah.
Audrey and people like that, pointing out that this was very remiss. And she had what she, because Dick Diamond was really didn't have any money, we agreed that we would give him Reedy River, and we just gave him the right to put it in the play, otherwise we'd have been millionaires or something by now.
Yes, you should have. You would have got quite a bit of money.
Actually, we get the we did register it with APRA, and I still do get performing rights for it.
Yes.
If anybody, you know, says they've done it.
Mm.
But I think that mostly comes from recordings that are played.
Yes.
But we gave it to Dick. But Helen stipulated, and this was put in the front of the performing edition of the play when it was issued by Heinemann's, that people who wanted to perform this play had to get permission from us to use Reedy River,
yeah.
And they had to get the proper version of it. And for years and years, she gave her address in Sydney, and for years and years, letters would come asking for permission, and I would send them the music and tell them how we did it in Reedy River,
yes.
How the best way to do it. I've got a file full of that Helen kept, full of permissions. And then various people wanted to put it in anthologies, or we discovered that they had and hadn't asked, and she always kicked up a fuss about it.
I saw it once somewhere at Reese, not too long ago, as a nun or trad.
That was the Bushwhackers did it. They issued a record of it as trad,
yeah.
And I made a big fuss
because
it was the Top of the Pops or something, because they were very fashionable, the Bushwhackers singing group.
That's right.
And they mucked it up, and they put her words on the front, and they altered them all, and they altered the tune, and made dreadful arrangements, and I made a big fuss with the record
company.
Did you
get any money out of them?
No, I didn't get anything. I wrote to the people in Bushwhackers,
yeah.
And they were... They weren't all that sorry, you know.
They
weren't very sorry, but the record. I asked the record company to withdraw it, and they said they had and would, but they took it a long time, and they didn't really. But eventually, and when it came out the second time, they put the proper words on and acknowledged.
Yes, the Bushwhackers were very well. They were the ones who, you know, called one their book, Pinch My Friend's Name, you know, the Take Your Partners and put it on.
Oh, yes. Well, they had absolutely no respect for...
Yeah, they saw themselves as left-wing, but they weren't...
No, they didn't care to it at all.
No, I see.
And they still went on doing it. And and when they... I think when they sing, they don't... When they sing publicly, 1891, I very much doubt whether they say who composed the words, yes, or who composed the music.
Well, there's not many people really who can say that they've composed a best-selling folk song.
Actually, I'm more proud of that than anything I've ever done, and I always tell people that when they're asking me about things I've done, which professionally have, you know, brought me kudos. I always tell them that I'm more proud of doing that than anything I've ever done, of writing 1891. And in fact, I always take it as a compliment when people think it's trad, because trad songs survive and lots of other songs don't.
Yes, well,
but I'm pretty fussy about how it's done. I really don't like it mucked about. No. I like it sung very straight.
Well, it sings very well straight.
It should be straight, and I'm always pleased when it's a
ballad in the heroic style, isn't it?
It is.
It's and a heroic ballad.
It comes off very straight, and it doesn't need all this pop stuff with it.
Yeah, it doesn't need any tiddly pomp.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't.
No.
They used that song. The Australian Library, the National Library, used that song. It was a couple of years ago when they put on... it was the centenary of the Labor Party. They did this big exhibition at the National Library.
In Canberra.
Yes. And a fellow came down from the library and asked for permission to use the song. And I had two recordings, and he took the old recording because he thought it was the better one. Yeah. And they acknowledged it, and they played it right through. It was one of the things that was on a tape of Australian songs, and it was on a sort of loop, and it just played right through that exhibition.
The next time you hear that song, The Ballad of 1891, remember it's been written by two women, Helen Palmer and Doreen Bridges, and it's not traditional, arranged by so-and-so, or Anon, or as I saw recently on YouTube, written by Ted Egan. No way, Jose. Just remember, Palmer, Bridges. But it's not the first time a woman has done something, and it's been claimed by a man.
Shearers, you might not be so keen. We can mount three. bells and rifles, and then we will show you what we mean. Then we will pack the westward troopers from Burke to Charters Towers, and you can have your fill of speeches, but the final strength is ours. Well, be damned to your six shooters and your orders for the squatters. They own the court above.